Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush today announced the withdrawal of 8,000 troops from Iraq by February and said he will send more troops to Afghanistan. Speaking at the National Defense University, President Bush said about 1,000 Marines scheduled to go to Iraq in November will go to Afghanistan instead, followed by about 4,000 soldiers in what the president called a quiet surge in Afghanistan. Well, what will those troops do there? A just-released report from Human Rights Watch says U.S. and NATO airstrikes in Afghanistan killed three times as many civilians last year as they did the year before, and those casualties are fueling growth of the Taliban and al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Mark Galasko is now senior military analyst at Human Rights Watch. But before that, he spent 7 years in the Pentagon as a senior intelligence analyst, where he was chief of high-value targeting for Iraq. That means that he decided where the bombs would fall. He directed them from a high-tech secure vault deep in the Pentagon. And Mark, can we start there? You know, as a civilian intelligence officer for the Pentagon, what was your job?
My job was to make the recommendations for targets, to sit there and speak with CENTCOM, CIA, NSA, and the other intel organizations, and kind of put together a picture of where we thought Saddam and his cronies were, and then where we thought that the bombs should go. But the actual, you know, sexy center was over in the Middle East, and right now it's in Doha in Qatar. And there you have both the Afghan air war and Iraq war being planned simultaneously. And it really is an amazing place where, you know, you go and it's very Star Trek-like, with flat screen televisions everywhere, just banks upon banks of computers, soldiers, airmen, Marines sitting at these computers and directing air traffic. And in fact, now what they do, you know, things have really leapt forward from when I was doing targeting, and we would sit there and make recommendations on video teleconference to each other. What they do now is they just basically text each other in these chat rooms. It's targeting via internet chat room. And so things are really moving forward now in a different way.
So I just want to be clear. You were telling others how to target missiles with the intelligence that you were gathering. But we read in a Washington Post article that you could actually see when these laser-guided bombs that you helped target hit. And you could watch on a screen. For instance, there's a description of a body flying like a rag doll across a video screen, and you could see that from the Pentagon.
Right, yeah, there was predator feed to the Pentagon, and at times for some of the targets, especially the really important ones, we could actually watch the attack as it unfolded, or we could watch a video of it immediately after it happened. The one that you're speaking about in particular was an attack against Chemical Ali in Basra. In that strike, there were two 500-pound bombs targeted on a building that we thought Chemical Ali was inhabiting, and he was Saddam's cousin. He had been involved in the Anfal campaign in 1988, killed many Kurds in northern Iraq. And so, you know, we thought this was where he was, very bad guy. The problem is, when the bombs actually hit target, we did not kill him. He had not been at the target, and ended up being two families destroyed or about 17 civilians killed, including many children.
Well, this is what you came to know when you went to Iraq and actually went to where the bomb fell. What was the transition for you from this high-value targeter to Human Rights Watch?
It was like cold ice being poured on me. It happened very rapidly. Certainly the decision to move out of the Pentagon was something that my wife and I had made months before, and, you know, had been looking for a job somewhere. When finally the Human Rights Watch job came open and we were doing the interviews, I said to them, listen, you know, if you're going to hire me, I really feel a responsibility to stay through the end of the invasion when my job there would really be over.
The invasion of Iraq.
The invasion of Iraq, because I felt I had a responsibility to the pilots flying the mission so that no one sends them against some idiot target, and also to the civilians on the ground. I mean, the reality is if I had left prior to the invasion, they just would have thrown some warm body in there. I wanted to make sure someone who really knew the target set was doing the job. And then when I went to Iraq with Human Rights Watch, you know, I was literally then standing in craters a week later, you know, face-to-face with victims from some of these attacks. And really learned the cost of civilian lives in warfare, and just how different it is when you're really there on the ground than when you're in some, you know, cozy room 3,000 miles away doing the thumbs up or thumbs down.
For instance, that body that you saw fly across a video screen that you and others thought might be Chemical Ali might have been the relative of someone you were now meeting in Iraq.
That's right. Yeah, I met an old man. Gosh, he must have been in his 70s. He was leathery. His fingers were just worn down almost to the bone from digging in the ground to dig his children and his grandchildren out of the earth. And, you know, to stand there in front of him and listen to the story about what happened from his perspective, and then knowing how we had done the targeting, it was a very difficult moment, and it's something I still think about.
By the way, what did the Iraqis say to you? Did they find out that you were the one that had, you know, directed the missile at them?
No, I've never told anyone that when I was there. I think it would be irresponsible. I mean, certainly it's something, you know, that would be dangerous as far as security goes. But also, you know, when you speak to victims and get victim testimony in conflicts, these are very vulnerable people. And to stand there and say, well, thanks for the story, by the way, you know, I was involved in that. Tough luck. We thought it was a good strike. You know, first of all, I would never put it that way, but I think that might be how it would come across to someone like that. Mm-hmm.
So now here you are, from targeter to someone who is trying to take an account of what the targeted bombs have done in both Iraq and Afghanistan as a member of Human Rights Watch. What is it you want to say? Because we just heard you say that you feel there have been advances in targeting, and we heard the excitement in your voice that, we heard the excitement in your voice at some of the new features of the targeting center that you were speaking of. But on the other hand, here you are with Human Rights Watch. So what are you trying to do with your new work?
Well, what I'm really trying to do is to educate the military, particularly the U.S. military, because they're involved so much in aerial operations, but other militaries as well. I mean, we saw Israel involved in an air war in 06, the Russians involved in a war in Georgia. I was just in Georgia during that conflict, and so I was able to see it firsthand. And to really bring my firsthand perspective from all of these conflicts and from knowing what it's like on the inside doing the planning, and try to explain to them, you know, what they're doing correctly and what they're doing incorrectly to try to improve civilian protections.
Well, what do you
and
say?
That's
to
really the bottom line.
Well, what do you say to people though who would say, you know, given what your very powerful testimony that, you know, a missile launched from a bunker wherever it is, that doesn't connect the targeter to the civilian, shouldn't happen at all. Why not a blanket condemnation of missiles and bombs?
Well, I think the reality is war is going to happen. I mean, you know, we're not talking about whether or not we should be fighting war, which is a separate conversation, and I think one that the nation probably needs to have. But the reality is wars are fought. And, you know, especially from the Human Rights Watch perspective, you know, we're trying to talk about the method and means in which wars are fought so that you can do it legally and improve the protections for civilians on the ground. The American psyche, I think, and the military in particular, is really sucked in by technology and this belief that, you know, technology cures all ills and we can do everything technologically. The reality is that's not the truth. On the ground, things look very differently than when you're sitting in your comfortable, air-conditioned room.
Well, let's get to the report that you and Human Rights Watch have just issued. It's not a blanket condemnation of the use of airstrikes in Afghanistan in particular. There are two issues you want to hear discussed. One has to do with ground forces, and one has to do with the judicious use of airstrikes. Tell us about those.
When it comes down to it, there are two types of airstrikes going on in Afghanistan. You have the planned airstrike and the unplanned airstrike. In the planned airstrike, the U.S. Air Force has basically removed civilian casualties as a problem. I've looked at them over the last 3 years. I've charted every single airstrike, and the listeners can go to www.hrw.org, and we have really an amazing interactive map. They can click on every airstrike for every day and see exactly what happened, how many tons went down, and how many civilians were killed. And it's a great tool to do analysis. But in these planned airstrikes over the last 3 years, we've seen almost no civilians killed. But it's in these troops in contact situation, the sudden appearance of a target in which we're really seeing civilians being killed. A troops in contact situation is, let's say you have a small force on the ground, they bump into the Taliban. We're really seeing much larger numbers on the Taliban side. And then they face a few choices, airstrike or withdrawal if they can. And withdrawal is not always possible, and so oftentimes they'll call in an airstrike.
Do you think there are too few U.S. troops on the ground? I mean, is that one of the problems that, U.S. forces might feel overwhelmed by the Taliban and be quicker to call in for the airstrikes?
Oh, absolutely. They are clearly replacing boots on the ground with bombs on target. They do not have enough folks to sustain a fight on the ground. But more importantly, they don't have enough folks on the ground to give them options. They need options such as capture before kill, such as cordon and search to go into a village and do a search before they actually drop weapons. They need to have options that they're not using because those options have been sucked away by the war in Iraq. There are overhead assets that they cannot use, such as increased Predator. Why? Because they're over in Iraq and they're being used there. Well, forces that are over there, capabilities that are over in Iraq. And so we see the effect of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan has now degraded Afghanistan to the point that there's just a massive uptick in airstrikes. I mean, you just look at June and July of 2008 alone. There were just as many bombs dropped in June and July as the entire year of 2006.
Well, let's talk about August 22nd. This was the raid on Azizabad. The U.S. military has maintained that only a handful of civilians were killed, along with 30 Taliban. Afghanis claim nearly 100 civilian deaths, and they say they have cell phone videos that back them up. A preliminary Afghan and U.N. investigation seems to support their claim, and the U.S. is now reinvestigating. But is that what you think happened? Again, there's an investigation ongoing, but do you think this is because of a lack of ground troops?
I think that's certainly part of it, but there are other things that go into play here. One of them is exactly what you're speaking about, the investigations. More often than not, it does not happen. The response by the U.S. is either we didn't do it or it was the Taliban's fault. Now, look, it's true. The Taliban are shielding. They're using human shields. And in my report, we go into that in great depth. But just because the Taliban are violating international law does not remove the requirement from the U.S. to always take all feasible precautions to protect civilians. And that's certainly something that we see as a problem. By having this constant knee-jerk, hey, it wasn't us, it's not our fault, they're not now having these important investigations on the ground that takes all of the information in. The investigations instead are opaque, they're unilateral, they're not working with the Afghan government or Afghan human rights commissions. And they're not doing the work on the ground. I mean, when I go into a place, into a conflict, just like when I was in Georgia just a few weeks ago, I'm doing it right there on the ground because that's the only way you can get all the information and really find out the truth. So by not having an investigation, that's the first problem. Okay, they're not getting lessons learned. The second issue, beyond just the number of troops on the ground, is you've got two wars being fought, Robin. And I don't think most people realize that. There is the U.S. counterterrorism mission, which is being fought out of Bagram Air Force Base, which is a U.S.-only effort. And then you have this NATO stabilization operation that's going on throughout the rest of the country. And the reality is the U.S. counterterrorism mission is really undermining the NATO stabilization mission. Why is that? Most of the casualties that we've seen caused by airstrikes and other incidents are caused by U.S. forces in this counterterrorism mission, in this manhunt. So you've got two separate missions, two separate leaders, two separate chains of command, two separate types of communications, separate forces. This counterterrorism mission is mostly black ops such as CIA and special operations forces, very poor communications. I mean, I'm sure you've heard the stories of the British down in Helmand province saying, look, we're in an area that we've now turned pro-government, and all of a sudden special forces show up. They get stuck. They call it an airstrike. They kill, 20, 30 civilians, and we're stuck cleaning up the mess. And, hey, they never called us in the first place to talk to us about the targets, and maybe we could have helped them out. So we've got a lot of things going on here that are leading to these civilian casualties.
That's Mark Alasko. Once a Pentagon bomb targeter, now says those bombs too often hit civilians. We'll have more with Mark. Later today, offshore drilling. Back in a minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with more from Mark Orlasco, now senior military analyst at Human Rights Watch, but he was once the Pentagon's chief of high-value targeting, deciding where bombs would land in places like Iraq. Now, the president said today that violence is increasing in Afghanistan because al-Qaeda is being driven from Iraq, but Mark says the spike in civilian casualties in Afghanistan is what is turning the people towards the Taliban and violence. So, Mark, let's continue. General David Petraeus is soon going to be leaving Iraq to take over the whole region. We hear President Bush today recommending that at least 4,500 more U.S. troops be sent to Afghanistan. And Petraeus was the man behind the boots on the ground, knock on the doors, know people in the region strategy in Iraq. So do you think that the situation is going to change soon enough in Afghanistan?
Well, I really hope so. And I hope that the folks in Afghanistan take General Petraeus's counterinsurgency field manual to heart. I mean, the field manual as it's been applied in Iraq has really, really helped turn the corner and really worked there. This idea that you're not just using kinetic force, that you're using other options, things besides bombs and bullets, using the whole array of different power and different buttons that you can push. We need that desperately in Afghanistan. I mean, it's not just that there's the Taliban coming in. You know, there are no jobs for people. There's poor, if any, infrastructure. And so you've got a lot of things that need to take place. But clearly we need to have this Army field manual come into effect there. We need to look at other options. And, you know, we need to recognize there's also a part of the field manual that's very important. It actually cautions against the overuse of air power. And I think that that's a chapter that they need to read over and over again in Afghanistan.
This is Mark Golasko. Colin Kahl, a professor of security studies at Georgetown University, says that he knows more about airstrikes than anyone in the world who isn't in the military currently. He is currently with Human Rights Watch. Well, Mark, we do want to ask you one last question. You are with Human Rights Watch now. But when you were a civilian working in the Pentagon with the Joint Intelligence Center at the Pentagon, as we said, you were there on 9/11 when the Pentagon was hit. You've said you felt violated. You didn't expect it coming. You know, you've spoken about that day. The anniversary of that day is coming up. And I'm wondering, you were a targeter, and you were sitting in what became a target. Now, I'm not pointing out any moral equivalency. I don't think there is one. This was a sneak attack by al-Qaeda. You, when you worked with the military, were working in a war. But I'm wondering, did you ever wonder, gee, this is what it must feel like to be at the other end of one of my bombs?
I mean, to some extent, but I think it's incredibly different because just physically. When I was in the Pentagon is a massive cement structure, very low to the ground. And I was working very deep in the earth, and the earth is an amazing insulator. And so when the building was struck on the south side, I was working on the north side and really didn't feel anything and didn't know about it until we were evacuated. And once I walked out of the vault in which I worked and was just struck by the smell of the burning horsehair insulation of the building.
We should say horsehair because it was so old.
That's right. Yeah, it was insulated with horsehair because it was built during the Second World War, and it was, an ersatz, a replacement material that was used for some more expensive insulation. And, you know, when I walked out of the building and looked up at the just huge column of black smoke, it just struck me at that point. And you know, being from New York City, I had friends here die in the World Trade Center. There were 20, I think at least 20 in my high school that were killed.
Oh.
Class. I went to Archbishop Molloy High School in Queens.
Oh.
And there was a young man who for 4 years sat behind me. I mean, you said alphabetically. And he was killed.
Oh.
He was a firefighter. So, 9/11 touches me in many ways. It's not just the Pentagon. I had my father-in-law's wife was working at 7 World Trade Center. My nephew was working in the World Trade Center at the time and luckily was stuck in traffic. So, yeah, it touches me in many ways. But, being at that moment, I don't think I had a realization of what it's like being a target as much as I did when I was in Lebanon in 2006 and was really put on my rear end by a variety of Israeli aerial weapons when I was very close to targets and started to get a little bit of an appreciation. But still, in no way have I gone through the type of psychological trauma, I think, that a victim does when their loved ones are killed right in front of them, when they have to dig themselves out of a building and start to, pull the loved ones out. I mean, one of the things we saw with the Azizabad case is, that there are so many dead who weren't accounted for originally by the U.S. military. Why? Well, because they were still buried when the U.S. military went there to do whatever it was that they did, and they didn't go in to do that long-term kind of analysis. And so the bodies only came out later. And so, while I think I've got a better feeling having been on the ground when bombs strike, I really think my appreciation has now come only from interviewing victims and being at these places when it happens. And it goes to one point that I like to make time and time again to the military. I really strongly, consistently encourage them to create some kind of an activity, an office, a person, whatever it is, whose sole job it is to go and investigate civilian casualties, who actually goes on the ground and learns from these and then inputs it back into the system, who knows how it's done and can take it back and make the important recommendations to the folks so that they know what changes they need to make so that this doesn't happen, because it is in their best interest. And, you know, part of it is, yes, we need to not kill civilians so that we don't have them come back at us, create more terrorists or whatnot, however you want to say it. But also just it's the right thing to do. And I think that that's very important. And being an American, you know, I think that's important to me, that I definitely see on the ground when I'm in Afghanistan, for example, that, you know, the Taliban fight differently. They don't uphold the Geneva Conventions. And, you know, we as Americans need to always be held to the highest standard. Why? Because that's the standard that we should expect to be held to.
Mark Galesko. And I just hasten to add that there are, of course, some people at the Pentagon that day who did know what it felt like to be a victim. I'm sure you're well aware. Mark, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And again, Mark is with Human Rights Watch. Their report says U.S. and NATO airstrikes in Afghanistan killed three times as many civilians last year as the year before. Mark was formerly a bomb targeter for the Pentagon. Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, the presidential election is looming. We'll speak with pollster John Zogby. He says don't forget the first globalists. That's what he calls young voters. And still ahead today, what the two campaigns are saying about drilling at home, and will the debate lead to government shutdown? Coming up Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Drill, baby, drill. Drill, baby, drill.
Republicans, led by former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, chanting for domestic oil drilling at last week's convention, to which Barack Obama responded yesterday from the campaign trail.
What were the Republicans hollering, drill, baby, drill? What kind of slogan is that?
Well, not since the 70s has energy been such a part of a presidential campaign. Republicans want to end the nearly three-decade-long congressional ban on drilling off the U.S. coast, they say, to reduce America's dependence on foreign oil. But Democrats say there would still be a dependence on oil, and drilling wouldn't produce all that much oil or produce it soon enough. But now Democrats are willing to compromise to get some other energy measures that Republicans loathe, and perhaps to get a few votes. 7 in 10 Americans support some form of offshore drilling. Well, Ben Geeman, a senior reporter for Environment and Energy Daily, he joins us. And Ben, Congress adjourns in 3 weeks, so every congressional vote is now a vote about the presidential election. But you write that the specter of a government shutdown is hovering here. Why? What could happen?
Well, yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, this has become a very heated debate about oil prices and oil drilling and the environment, all set against this election season backdrop. And the reason that there's at least the outside specter looming of a government shutdown is because, you know, as you point out, right now, these existing drilling bans, which have been in place for decades, the way that these bans keep getting renewed is that each year, through the federal spending process, Congress puts them in the Interior Department spending bill. And what's going to happen over the next few weeks, because this whole congressional spending process is pretty much stalled, is that we're going to see something called a continuing resolution that's aimed at keeping the government spending, you know, government functions going after the end of the federal fiscal year. Now, Republicans, however, are saying when this continuing resolution to continue federal spending surfaces, it should not include these longstanding bans on drilling, which right now cover the Atlantic coast and the Pacific coast and most of the eastern Gulf of Mexico.
But Democrats have said they're willing to compromise on offshore oil drilling. Speaker Nancy Pelosi said as much. Barack Obama has said he's willing to consider offshore drilling if it's part of a larger plan. So what do Democrats want in return for passing that spending bill and maybe lifting a ban? What is in some of the House proposals?
Well, this is very interesting. What the House Democrats are saying, and, you know, similar to the Senate Democratic position, is, you know, they're not interested in an outright wholesale lifting of the bans. What they are saying is that there could be perhaps a modest expansion of offshore drilling, but there's an if there, and the if there is they would want to couple it with a lot of things that Republicans have been traditionally opposed to. And a couple of those would be repeal of some oil industry tax breaks and royalty subsidies. And they also, in the House, want to couple it with something called a renewable electricity standard. And that essentially requires utilities to supply escalating amounts of power from renewable sources. Now, those types of things have had longstanding Republican opposition as well as drawn White House veto threats. So I think what's unfolding here is that the Democrats, because of some of the increased pressure for drilling and these high prices, feel a little bit backed into a corner and have had to sort of concede and offer something on offshore production. But the fact that they've coupled it with these other traditional Democratic priorities, which the Republicans are very much opposed to, suggests to me that we're really headed towards some kind of stalemate here. It's fluid, but right now it looks like it's a highly political debate, and I don't see a huge amount of give and take.
Well, the Democrats are saying that when they say end oil company tax breaks and subsidies, they want to put that money towards renewable fuels. And as we've said, the Democrats are also saying they're willing to compromise. Is this politically risky for the Republicans as well, not to be seen as compromising? And they've been staging a protest on the floor of the House over the August recess, giving speeches demanding just an up or down vote on lifting the ban on offshore drilling without any compromise. You know, so I'm wondering, you know, why doesn't the Republican side see the need to do some compromise?
Well, you've hit on the dynamic quite nicely, actually. I mean, the Republicans have felt like they've got a very strong campaign issue with this pro-drilling campaign. And what the Democrats are trying to do is turn the tables a little bit and say, hey, look, you've wanted these votes on drilling. Well, here's a vote on drilling, but you're going to have to swallow a whole series of other things that you've had a longstanding opposition to.
Well, let's get some facts out about offshore drilling. We've discussed this before, but what is the sense of how much oil or gas would be gotten through drilling and how long it would take and how safe is it?
Well, in the eastern Gulf of Mexico, there's generally considered to be some substantial resources there. I mean, the most recent Interior Department estimate I saw was on the order of roughly 3 billion barrels of oil in the off-limits parts of the eastern Gulf. And off the Atlantic coast, where there's also some consideration of drilling, some of the bipartisan plans would call for some exploration off the coast of the Carolinas and Virginia and Georgia. There, it's a little trickier. I mean, there's potentially very significant finds there, but on the other hand, it's been a very long time, if ever, since there's been any real exploration there. And so I think what you're seeing is that some uncertainty about exactly how large the resources would be in these areas that haven't been explored in quite a long time, if ever.
And we're hearing analysts who are saying it could be as up to 7 to 10 years to come to fruition.
That's right. I mean, even if the whole coastlines were opened up tomorrow, we're not going to see an effect on these energy prices anytime soon. These are big projects with big infrastructure that take a lot of time to get going. And even before you can even start to bring the equipment offshore, there's a whole federal leasing process with lease sales and environmental studies and comment periods. So, no, there's not going to be any overnight drilling, and there's not going to be any overnight or even over a year effect on prices.
Well, the ban on offshore drilling came about because Unocal Corporation caused a huge spill off Santa Barbara in California. But industry leaders say the technology is safer now. But I want to move on, and just we spoke about Barack Obama, but I want to mention John McCain as well. He was against offshore drilling. Now he's for it. He and his running mate Sarah Palin disagree on drilling in ANWR. This is the onshore drilling in Alaska. She is for it. He is against. How much does this injection of an Alaskan governor who is pro-drilling affect this debate?
I mean, I think it affects it in a couple different ways. One is it serves to increase the emphasis on energy that's already been very high as we've seen these record level oil prices. Now they've receded substantially and prices at the pump have gone down, which, as a bit of a side note, I think takes at least a little bit of the pressure off the issue, although not much. But yeah, the injection of Palin into the race is quite interesting. Now, she is, of course, as you point out, in favor of drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. That's something that McCain has long been opposed to and continues to be opposed to it. So there's a bit of a difference there. But they both do favor more offshore production.
Well, Ben, you know, we began by saying there might be a shutdown, but you say that that's doubtful of the government. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I'd be very surprised if any of these broad energy packages that are being floated out there in the House and the Senate ultimately become law. And a lot of that has to do with timing. And we've got this short 3-week sprint until Congress wants to go back home for campaigning. And the idea that you'd have, you know, a big bill get through the House, a big bill get through the Senate, and then some type of ultimate compromise reached all within a matter of a few weeks on issues that have been debated for decades is a little hard to imagine. On the other hand, I think if both sides do become sufficiently terrified of this outside prospect of a government shutdown, then I think you could see some possibility of a compromise. But right now, you know, unfolding against the backdrop of the election, the atmosphere is very, very charged, very, very partisan, and I think each side would be very reluctant to hand the other something that they could sort of take onto the campaign trail and call a victory.
Ben Geeman, senior reporter for Environment and Energy Daily, will watch this unfold over the next couple of weeks. Ben, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on the program.
And what do you think about this or anything on the program? You can email us at letters@here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, they got on the New York subway without their pants. Put on a musical in the food court of a Los Angeles mall.
Lemonade spilt across the countertop. There's ice and lemons everywhere now. I gotta clean it up.
They are part of a national trend of guerrilla thespians. They're Improv Everywhere, a New York-based group whose motto is We Cause Scenes, and boy, do they. Charlie Todd is the creator. Charlie, a lot of people are familiar with your work because of one mission in particular, Frozen Grand Central. What did you do there?
Well, Frozen Grand Central was a mission that we did. It was in the middle of winter. We got 200 people together to go to Grand Central Station here in New York, and at the exact same second, everyone froze in place. And they froze in place for exactly 5 minutes, and then at the moment the time was up, everyone continued moving and walking as if nothing had happened at all.
Now, the video of this has been seen by 13 million viewers on YouTube. We'll post it at our website as well. Law and Order paid homage to it in one episode with Robin Williams.
Yeah, in fact, Robin Williams has been nominated for an Emmy essentially for his portrayal of me, which I think is hilarious.
Well, especially because wasn't Robin Williams, in addition to being, you know, you, a murderer?
Yes, because it was Law and Order, he was also a murderer. it was very interesting to see how that idea spread.
What kind of commentary do you think the producers are making about your urban improv?
Well, it's funny. I mean, the group was clearly inspired by us because, you know, it's a group based in New York City that goes out and does these sort of public spectacles. But the thing that was different about them is the motive behind it. Improv Everywhere is a group that's focused on creating scenes of chaos and joy in public places. And we do it for comedy for comedy's sake. And we think it's so much more interesting to give someone that experience that they were sitting on the subway car and one guy got on in his underwear, and I thought that was weird. And then another guy got on in his underwear, and they acted like they didn't know each other, which is so much better than, like, well, then I saw them cracking up.
Or they pulled out a placard that said, you've been punked. Yeah. You don't do that.
Yeah, we typically do not have a reveal moment where we reveal that it has been a prank. Instead, we just leave the scene of the crime and let people draw their own conclusions.
Scene of the crime. Are these crimes? For instance, you put on missions in public places, and one, you call them agents, the people who show up. They dressed up in blue polo shirts and browsed a Best Buy megastore. Customers thought they were employees, asked them for advice. Some of your, quote, agents even sold some products, you know, and the real employees called the police.
The majority of the people who were in the Best Buy that day actually had a really great time. All of the lower-level employees were absolutely cracking up and couldn't believe it. The managers and security guards, I guess it's their job to respond to anything that is out of the ordinary.
Yeah, like 80 people selling items that don't belong to them, things like that.
Well, listen, we weren't taking items that didn't belong to us. I told people, you know, don't claim that you work there. But if somebody asks you a question, you know the answer, feel free to be a helpful human being and help them out. I put on a blue shirt myself. A woman asked me where to find The Sound of Music on DVD, and I very helpfully took her over to the DVD section.
Another time, two of your followers were arrested for unnecessary noise. I remember when this was in the news, they put on a fake U2 concert on their rooftop. Hundreds of people gathered below. They think this is the real U2.
That took place back in 2005 when the real U2 was performing at Madison Square Garden. We had access to a rooftop across the street from Madison Square, and I put four guys dressed up like U2 who were musicians and who played a live U2 concert with a rented PA system, And there are 20,000 U2 fans in the area on the way to the concert who all of a sudden think U2 is playing a surprise gig on a rooftop.
See, you know, it's reminding me of Mrs. Potato Head, who, as she famously said, it's only funny till someone loses an eye. Do you worry that someone might get hurt because you're placing 200 people at times in the middle of New York City?
We do plan these things out in advance. When we did our U2 mission, we had someone who was on the street whose job it was to make sure that everybody stayed out of the street. We kept everyone on the sidewalk. So we do things to make sure that although we are creating a chaotic event, things don't get out of hand.
Charlie Todd, creator and senior agent of Improv Everywhere based in New York City. Charlie, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And this is The Real U2. Really? Coming up, The Real Tooth Fairy. That's in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we all know there are tooth fairies, of course. We now know they're called Skibbereen. They're only a couple inches tall. They live in colonies like ants, and they have to be careful not to be crushed if you roll over while they try to retrieve your tooth, just as I suspected. Author Gregory Maguire, who also thought outside the box about The Wizard of Oz when he wrote the book Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West, that was made into a musical. He wrote the book's sequel as well, Son of a Witch. Then he tackled the topic of the tooth fairy.
To start with, he wasn't much to look at, literally. I mean, he was slight and small. I also mean he blended in. His arm webs were filmy, nearly transparent, and his skin was suggestible, like water. I suppose his circulation worked on a capillary system. His coloring could shift from pale to dark, and many shades in between. A limited talent for camouflage. Not enough to make himself invisible, nothing like that. But he wasn't much to look at even when you could see him right in front of you, or when measured up against others of his kind. His head was flat in back, and his nose was more beaky than perky. His hair flew everywhere, as if eager to get off his scalp. His neck was a toothpick, his arms toothpicks, his legs toothpicks with big flattened feet. Most Skibbereen have slender feet that come to a point, like sharpened pencils, like ballet folk on their ballet toes. But our hero's feet were made for walking.
That's Gregory Maguire reading from his book, What the Dickens? The Story of a Rogue Tooth Fairy, which was recently released in paperback. We spoke with him when the book was first published. You know, I had pictured the Tooth Fairy was sort of, you know, like the good witch in The Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
And very loving and bestowing upon us the coin. These tooth fairies are like harried ants.
Well, they have a lot of work to do. And if you're only 2 inches tall,
yes,
in a world of beasts and automobiles and noisy sleeping human beings, you need to have backup. So the tooth fairies have a lot of backup. They work together to get the teeth. They work together to use them. And they work together to make sure that their colonies can survive.
I think we can reveal what the tooth fairies do with the teeth.
I was so glad when I finally figured it out.
Yeah.
Because what do you do with a dead piece of bone?
Exactly.
I mean, I decided they must bury them. But then, what do they grow up into? And I realized that what they grow up into is a birthday candle. Not just any birthday candle, but a birthday candle capable of actually delivering the wish that might be made upon it.
And I always wondered, where do they get the coins?
Well, they have to scavenge for coins. Most of us have to hunt around in the pockets of our jeans or in the car seat when we get to the toll booth. And Skibbereen are very smart. They watch how human beings lose money, and they just hang around and pick up the spare change.
As one of the characters says in the book, you think you know about tooth fairies, but hello, you really don't. And we're finding out from Gregory Maguire what they really do. Into this world that you reveal to us of the tooth fairy, you bring in the tooth fairy named What the Dickens. As it turns out, tooth fairies, when they're born, immediately learn how to speak. And his name comes because, what, a human sees him and...
And the first words a human boy who sees him says is, "What the Dickens?" The little tooth fairy, who is an orphan and is separated from his tribe by accident of birth, thinks, well, that must be my name, what the Dickens. And it seems appropriate because he's a bit of a pilgrim in Pilgrim's Progress. He has to find his own way around without benefit of a solid education.
Well, you set the story within another story. It's a tale that's told by Gage, who's babysitting his cousins in a really apocalyptic feeling time. There's been a Katrina-like storm. The kids are left alone at the house. The parents have gone maybe to get insulin for Mom. You know, they're gone. It's very Lord of the Flies-ish in the beginning. And then Gage, the babysitter, begins to tell them this story. I mean, that's a very dark story that you open with.
It's the story that came up and surrounded the Tooth Fairy inventions as I was beginning to think about the novel. It didn't seem to me that I wanted to spend 200 pages just writing about the Tooth Fairy colony. And so I thought, what do people in desperate times really need? And the one thing that was available during Katrina, as people huddled under underpasses and in sports arenas, was story and song. Mm. So what Gage is giving to these kids who have nothing left is a story to distract them, and it's hoped to encourage them.
Well, and apparently it's a story from Gage's own life. Apparently as a child, we don't want to give too much away, but he trapped a tooth fairy. She's thinking to herself, and this is back in time with the young Gage, geez, what are we going to have to do? We're going to have to abandon the colony. We'll hire woodworms and carpenter ants to chew our careful chambers into disrepair. The undertree common will be history. In other words, she's thinking, oh my God, we're going to have to destroy the whole complex now that I'm found out. And as Gage has her trapped, you know, in his little bedroom, he interrogates her. In fact, do you mind if we read this segment together?
No, not at all. I'd love to.
Yeah, page 223.
Can you shed any light on Santa Claus?
Not my department.
Easter Bunny? Four-leaf clovers? Leprechauns and rainbows and pots of gold?
Pots of bunk, if you ask me, but I'm not an expert witness.
Wishing on a star? Wishing on a coin thrown in a fountain?
Pepper didn't want to talk about wishes because a wish was just exactly what she wished to have. The use of right now, she drew her arms around her small legs and huddled into a tighter bundle. No comment. I mean, it just goes to... These are really edgy tooth fairies.
They have a hard row to hoe. Let's face it. Teeth are not pretty things. My six-year-old lost her first tooth in France. We were traveling as a family. The waiter in the cafe was astounded and delighted and went to get her an extra ice cream to celebrate the loss of her first tooth. While we were all laughing with her and happy about it, a car at the edge of the cafe thunked into a human body, and our seven-year-old was missing. For 1 minute, we did not know where he was. We did not know. We couldn't get through the crowd to see what had happened. It wasn't him. It was somebody else who stepped off a train and walked into traffic. But for 1 minute, as Helen was celebrating this moment of joy and fun, our other child was lost, and we were worried about him. That's really what the story is about, in a sense, this novel, What the Dickens. It's about how we have to thread our lives between so many possibilities of danger and tragedy and joy and celebration.
And what a way of illustrating it. Well, you know, you mentioned your kids. I just want to say one of them is in the other room. He's a little guy, Alex. And as I'm looking at him, he looks strangely like the description of a skibbery, absent the web-like wings.
You have got it in one, as they say in England.
So we see maybe a little of, maybe not just your childhood, all of our childhoods, but your child.
That's right. People always said to me when I started having my children, do you think they're going to change how you write? And I didn't think for a long time that it had. But then I was writing the description of What the Dickens. And it's true. Alex came up with his tiny little hips and his tiny little pencil-thin feet and his big head and inquisitive eyes and his way of beating against the world in a very useful and helpful and annoying way. That's What the Dickens, at least in part.
Yeah. But oddly enough, you haven't read the book to him yet.
No, I haven't. I don't want him to think that I'm inventing everything about the Tooth Fairies. He knows my name. He knows how to read my name on the cover of a book. He might think that I'm just making all this up. It's better that he should find the lore of the Tooth Fairies out for himself.
Gregory Maguire, author of What the Dickens, the story of a rogue tooth fairy. It's now in paperback. And he sent us this email update. Gregory writes, I did begin to read parts of the story to Alex and his younger sister Helen, and they interrupted me quite firmly to add details of tooth fairy protocol, about which I was proving quite unaware, like that tooth fairies are wary of toothpaste because it can trap them. The conversation shifted to other dogmatic matters like Santa Claus and how he goes undercover to take a holiday, etc. And the real tooth fairy, if listening in the wings, no doubt breathed a sigh of relief at the fragile and limited attention spans of children, which enables the tooth fairies to survive. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here Now.